I like a lot of them artists, but I thought it was crap. Got a dream boy, got a song, paint your wagon and come along. When the time will know, when will be there, I ain't certain. What will I get, I ain't equipped to say. But who gives a damn, who gives a damn, we're on our way.
Hello and welcome to the Sound of Football podcast, World Cup 2026. I'm Graham Sibley, and as ever, I'm joined by Jan Bilton.
Hello.
And Terry DeFellin.
Hello.
Yes, we're joined by Terry from Norfolk on line one. Great to hear you, Terry. What do you want to talk about tonight?
Anyway, love for the family, Graham. Love for the family.
Are we on TalkSport?
Yes. If Terry sounds a bit different this week, that's because he's actually joining us from holiday. He's gone away for a few days, but ever the trooper, ever the pro, he's joined us on the phone to cover the end of the tournament because the final was yesterday. It's Monday night, as ever, as we record. The final of the World Cup was last night. And so, of course, we've been following it every week over the last few weeks. And so we did need to come together, all three of us, to talk about it, to decompress and to just analyse what has gone on and the lessons we can all learn as well. But before we start on the World Cup and the final and everything like that, we do have to talk about something else that happened today that we found out just about an hour or so before we press record. And that was the sad news that Kevin Keegan died. And lads, I know we're all of an age, so I know Terry and I are old enough to remember Keegan as the player, but obviously Jan as well, you know him as a manager probably better than the player. And as a manager, of course, he had his period managing England, but of course he had a very successful period managing Newcastle as well. So, I mean, you would have probably known more about him from that period of his career. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. And that's what comes to mind straight away when I think of the man. Obviously, coming from the correct side of the Tyne, he was one of the enemy. But I don't ever remember feeling any kind of malice towards him because he was so successful. And of course, he'd been a national hero, such a successful player in his own right, and transitioned and made a difficult transition to becoming a really successful coach. And he took Newcastle to the very, very brink of greatness and will be remembered, fondly remembered, for his, could you say, losing it, maybe more of an outburst when he was talking about his relationship with Ferguson and Manchester United, and he came out with, I would love it if we'd beat them, I'd love it, which was great. It was real passion, but I think at the same time, that I think signified Newcastle dropping off that season. But it made it one of the great seasons in the top flight in memory. You know, he contributed to that. And in Newcastle, he'll be remembered very, very fondly. And I'd imagine there'd be a few glasses deservedly raised in his memory tonight. So yes, rest in peace, Kevin Keegan.
Terry, that outburst is certainly going to be one we're going to see a lot of over the next few days. But I was just talking about it with Sam White, actually, on social media. And I was reflecting on the fact that at the time, Sky was actually still quite staid in its presentation and its format. And back then, we didn't really have this whole sort of panto thing about football. That came afterwards. And really, he was on his own doing that at the time. And I think that's probably why it seemed so out of place. He was panto. He was showbiz, wasn't he? And he tried to bring that. And there was no one else coming along with him. And I think it was only until Mourinho turned up that you actually get that coming into what football is today, isn't it?
Maybe I'm naive, but I think there's an awful lot of authenticity about the I would love it. I think he genuinely loses control in that moment. And in fact, that's uncharacteristic because actually Keegan has been an icon and a personality for so many years by that point that he had an excellent media persona and was well media trained. He knew how to handle himself in the media, and it was a rare moment where he lost control. But what it also did is it foreshadowed the heated social media clips that are all the rage now of, like, these, you know, dare I say it, on occasion, somewhat performative outbursts that we often see that then get clipped so that they can be shared on the social. And that's one of the originals, but it was somewhat more authentic than I think some of the stuff that we might see. Graham, you and I are of that age, because we've just got a little bit more, a few more years on Jan. So we were children when Kevin Keegan was a footballer, when he was playing for Liverpool and then playing for Hamburg. And he was a champion, both in England and in Germany. He was a Ballon d'Or winner. And he was also a man who was quite happy to go on television. He came from a poor working class background, and bluntly, you know, like a good pro, he took every opportunity for endorsements and for money that he could because of where he came from, because he, you know, came from a mining town with very little expectations of doing anything with his life and went on to become an absolute icon. And when we were kids, Graham, I mean, he was, I would suggest, as ubiquitous and probably as iconic as, you know, Messi and Ronaldo are today, only very much, you know, in England, you know, or perhaps in Great Britain, not necessarily the international superstar. Technology and communications being what they are today, you know, footballers are able to be international icons, global icons. You know, Keegan didn't live in that world, but if he had, maybe he would have done. Because he also did things like Green Cross Code campaigns and stuff like that. He was, I think, to a lot of children, Keegan was to be worshipped. And I think that I worshipped him in my own, in a very sort of like innocent, childish way. And it's, yeah, that stays with you. And I think as he got on into his managerial career, and as we all grew up and became men, and he became a manager and an older man, I don't think that I ever lost that with Keegan. And I think that that's why his Newcastle team was so spellbinding, because a lot of it was because it was Keegan, and Keegan was my hero. And I couldn't shake that, I don't know, 8-9-year-old boy who saw him as such. And I suppose then, you know, when you move on to later in his career, some of the more painful moments, particularly around England, that they were even more painful because, you know, I liked Keegan and I didn't want Keegan to fail. I thought it would have been amazing if Keegan had been a successful England manager, because it would have been England and it would have been Keegan. It just would have been great. But I think that's what he means, certainly to our age group, Graham, because we caught the full force of him when he was in his pomp and in his prime as a player.
I remember Kevin Keegan from before I even knew about football. That's how big he was. This is the guy who was turning up on television to sell you sugar puffs, aftershave, road safety. He was everywhere. And you're right, he was ubiquitous. If you could put Kevin Keegan's face on something, it would be on something. One of the first games, and I think it probably is the first game I ever sat down consciously to watch, was England's qualifier in 1977 against Italy at Wembley. I doubt whether I would have been allowed to watch the whole game, because it was on a Wednesday night. It was on ITV on a Wednesday night. So I'd probably only been allowed to watch the first half, but England needed to win 4-0. You can get the whole match on YouTube. Of course you can get the whole match on YouTube. This 49-year-old match. And in it, he plays a very, very typical Kevin Keegan performance, scores the opener, lays on the second goal for Trevor Brooking, takes an elbow in the face from Tardelli, a real whack in the chops, and gets up and keeps on playing. It sums up the guy, really, the way he played. And I really encourage you to watch at least the highlights of that match. I did earlier on today to take me back to when I was a young lad. But yeah, I'm looking forward over the next few days to reading a lot of tributes for Kevin Keegan. Lots and lots of good memories. I don't think anyone is going to have a bad word to say about him, really, because he's just that kind of guy. And really, football really should produce a lot more of them. But sadly, it doesn't. But Kevin Keegan will be fondly remembered here, and I think everywhere as well. But I guess we're here to talk about the World Cup, aren't we?
Well, yeah. Frankly.
And well, yeah, I mean, that was the title of the podcast after all. And it finished last night after over a month of play, after 104 games. The 104th game was played yesterday. And to be honest, it was pretty dull, wasn't it, Jan? It was pretty rubbish. But that's only because only one team turned up to play football, didn't they?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was what Argentina played was anti-football, if it was anything. I mean, just looking at the stats of the game, I won't reel them all off, but I mean, it just shows the lack of any kind of ambition to try and win the game. Although they only really, you know, let the shackles off in the last couple of minutes, where actually, you know, Spain were already ahead and they were forced to go and try and salvage the game. But before that, it was awful. It really was. I mean, we got to the point, I think, at one point in the game that Spain had more than 80% possession, and it was crazy. Quite a bizarre thing to watch, if I'm honest with you, considering it's the showcase game of the biggest competition in the world. And maybe because of that, they were being just too cagey. I don't think Spain were being cagey at all. I mean, Spain just kept the ball and looked really cool and looked great and were almost machine-like in how precise they were. They were worthy winners in a game that I think is, for the football, is forgettable. You know, it wasn't a classic. You know, it wasn't like the third place playoff, which didn't matter one bit. I didn't watch that game because it didn't matter. Other people told me, oh, you missed a cracker. And I went, well, yeah, but it didn't matter, did it?
But you did miss a cracker.
Yeah, but what hung over that game was what happens, well, I suppose throughout it, more into the second half, with the antics of the players, which we saw a lot of in the semi-final, which I know we'll come to later. But that really became quite unpleasant. And for a side as talented, crammed full of talent, ability and history and legacy, to behave like they did before the final whistle and certainly after the final whistle was an absolute shame on that entire nation and put a black mark really against the final. I think it really left a bitter pill, and it's just not the way it should be, really. So it's a shame that it will, I think, forever be remembered as that being an aspect of it. However, that aside, Spain's win was complete. They were brilliant considering what they were facing. I watched it with a friend of the show, Aid, and we all wore Spanish shirts. We all had tortillas, and we just enjoyed the win. So it was great to share it with somebody who was, you know, absolutely rooting for Spain for obvious reasons. We were all rooting for Spain for other obvious reasons. But yeah, it was wonderful in the end. It was good to see the good guys won.
Yes, they did, which doesn't always happen. Terry, was that final as bad as the 2010 final, do you think? Spain's the common denominator here, isn't it?
Spain are so amazingly functional and competent. It's just breathtaking. They have taken functionalism and competency to such levels of competency that I was just blown away by their massive competency. They're not the most entertaining team to watch, unless, of course, you're a football purist and you just love watching professionals just like playing football really, really well and with maximum competence. But there's no fire or energy, I think, you know, that when you're watching them as a neutral. Sure, it's incredibly different when you've got skin in there, you're Spanish, or you've decided to be Spanish for an evening, or you're in a pub full of Spanish people and they're all like getting behind it, then that's a different matter. But, you know, when you're looking at it with sort of like the dead-eyed neutrality of someone whose team got knocked out in the semi-final, they don't quite capture the imagination. As, say, Argentina do when they play well, because they play as though they are dancing on the edge of a knife. And they did that in this game as well. It's just that it just fell apart for them. Or it never really came together to begin with. Spain just completely sucked the life out of them. And all that they had left was their shenanigans and housery, which is nowhere close enough to winning a football match, especially against the best team in the world. And especially when they lose a player as well. And didn't we all enjoy that? That was terrific. Enzo, take a bow, son. Take a bow, son, and your terrible, really, really awful football club. It was very much like 2010 with, obviously, Holland in the Argentina role. Or we started to say Argentina in the Holland era. Not quite as bad, because Holland got away with some ridiculous fouls. Howard Webb, take a bow. Really just letting so much go. So it did have a lot of those kind of vibes to it. And there was a moment when I was sitting there in the half time of the extra time and thought, I think Argentina could nick this. I really do think they could nick it. But within seconds, Spain win, And I was about to say at that point, the result was never in doubt, but it was, wasn't it? Because,
oh, yeah.
And here's the thing, I mean, when we come to talk about England, this is something to just take, bear in mind. Despite everything that Spain have, despite all the control that they have, they still backed off and allowed Messi to play down those channels in those final few moments of that game when they had spent the previous X number of minutes stopping them from doing that. So just go to show you what happens where you place yourself under that kind of pressure. But it was disappointing in that respect. I'm not in a kind of, oh, I'm not angry, I'm just disappointed kind of way. I'm not here to scold Argentina for the way they play football. That is the way they play football. When it works, it's all tears and smiles and like, oh, look at the fans. Oh, Messi's the go. Isn't it amazing? And then when they fail, they're a bunch of man baby thugs who can't stand losing and take it with a lack of dignity and class. And that's it, one or the other. And that's the trade-off. And I suspect that most Argentines are kind of comfortable with that because a lot of the time they win. So who's won more World Cups, England or Argentina?
Well, exactly. Hey, I actually quite enjoyed the final, actually. I thought it was pretty good. Spain are the Arsenal of Europe now, aren't they? And yes, they weren't the team playing the anti-football. That's what anti-football is, listeners. If you've been listening to people all season telling you that Arsenal played anti-football, no, Argentina came and showed you perhaps a more extreme version of anti-football. But I suppose it was disappointing that England weren't there, wasn't it? And really the worst thing about that Argentine performance was the fact that you would have hoped that England would have given a better game to Spain in the final. Perhaps they would have done if they'd given Argentina a decent game in the semi-final. Jan, how angry were you after the semi-final?
Well, I went through all of the stages of grief, I suppose, with that. But I was more bewilderment, really, as to being really on the front foot and positive across the game to taking a lead and then parking the bus in a game where they, I just did not think. I was with a friend who has a UEFA B qualification and was telling me that England will just soak this up because they deal with this. They've got giant centre-backs who will just head these away all evening. And for a large part of it, they did that. But I just didn't see that that park the bus mentality was going to hold up for long because Argentina, as we've said, are a really good side. They didn't get into the semi-finals because they won the lottery. They got in there because they're a really good team and they've got arguably the best player in the world that we didn't really contend. Obviously, the winning goal came down the right channel, which he provided the cross for. It was bewildering for me that that tactic was chosen just to kind of sit behind the ball and hopefully ride it out with that amount of time to go. It was awful. It really was to witness. I'm not a professional football coach. I don't even have a UEFA B. But looking at that game, I was, yeah, just shocked that we took that stance. And I've had discussions with people about this since. I'm like, yeah, but that's how you grind out results. And it might well be how you grind out results if your side plays together week in, week out,
yeah,
over the course of many seasons and you're drilled on this every single day in training. But international football, you don't have that luxury. These players, you know, come together every few months and they'd been together a few weeks, really. You know, to hope to do that against a side that had to come for you and had goals in them, not having a more balanced approach. I'm not saying that maybe you do have to be a bit more defensive and be a little bit more careful and cautious and hope to catch them on the break. But there was just no outlet for England. It was everyone behind the ball and it was very, very negative, lacked any kind of thought of how they were going to get out of it. Should they concede a goal? There was no contingency in there as far as I saw it. I thought Tuchel did really well to get England there. There were some great performances. There were some questionable performances. And I thought in the second half of that game, that was pretty questionable and regrettable and ultimately led to England being eliminated. So yeah, wasn't great from my point of view.
Yeah, Terry, in that second half, there was a period of 18 minutes where England made just 3 successful passes.
Yeah.
Which was utterly ridiculous. And in the middle of that period, Tuchel makes the decision, makes a double substitution, takes off Reece James, who was injured, and Declan Rice, and brings on Dan Byrne and Nico O'Reilly. Is that the worst substitution ever made by an English manager?
Yeah, conceivably. If it's not that, then it's Gordon for Konsa a few minutes earlier.
Yeah.
Because I think that's where it maybe it stems from. I was puzzled by Thomas Tuchel's remarks after the match, where he sort of said, well, we saw that the players had sat back and were playing defensively, so we tried to help them by bringing on more defenders. Like, yeah, no, I don't have a UEFA B either. I've never coached a side, so I don't know. But I had kind of always imagined that the role of a coach, particularly in an in-game situation, would be to see if a team is playing in such a way as to say, well, look, this is going to cost us the game. They need to change. This is what we're going to do. I would have liked to have thought of the hydration break. It would have been a case of, like, you're playing too defensively. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to maybe swap out Gordon for a Rashford or for Saka and give some pace and give an outlet and give the Argentines something to think about, something to worry about. Because at the moment, it's attack versus defence. But to lean into this was a real surprise to me. And I don't really quite follow the logic of that. I can understand, obviously, in the round of 16, we played Mexico, went to Mexico. We played the final stanza of that game with 10 men. But really, Mexico weren't really as good as Argentina, were they? Mm. Argentina, when they went a goal down, they absolutely turned it on. And it looked to me as though an equaliser was inevitable and that we should probably be getting ready for extra time, that we weren't going to be able to see this out at 1-0. And I would have thought that would have been the safer assumption. But it seemed to me that there was as UEFA B guy says, and I hope he's well, that they were confident that they might be able to see that game out. But I mean, like, they hit the post twice, I think, before the equalising goal. And you just knew the way that they were going, that they would find a second goal, to be perfectly honest with you. It just felt watching it. And I guess that maybe a lot of that is a generations of England trauma affecting how we're seeing the game. And that's not trauma that Thomas Tuchel shares. And maybe he looks at that and say, yeah, we can close this game out. This is fine. But I'm not convinced. I thought it was a rare moment from a coach who's actually an elite level coach, really misjudging the situation very badly. Yeah. And I mean, like I said, you know, like in the Spain game, I mean, when you start giving Messi that space, he's going to punish you. But up until the Gordon goal, we had the situation under a fairly large degree of control, actually, insofar as we were playing the world champions. We had a foothold in this game and a foundation with which to go on and win it. And to lose in this way is possibly the worst. We've gone from the best result in England's history in Mexico to possibly the worst in the space of a couple of games. It was a terrible way to lose a football match.
It was. I saw maybe flippant remarks from Chelsea fans saying, well, this is what you get with Tuchel. But you've known clubs managed by Tuchel for even longer than they have. So did this surprise you, Terry?
A little bit. But obviously, we'd seen Mexico. So you know that he had done that. But yes, I mean, I was surprised. I would have expected Tuchel to think, because there was that period after the goal and before the hydration break when we were just defending on the 6-yard line. Like, we can't keep this up for the rest of the game. That's just not going to work. These players are just too good. You know, we can't just, like, it's not a question of just, like, putting Dan Byrne at the back there and him just, like, sit on Raul Jimenez for 20 minutes and win the game. That's not how it's going to happen. And that's not how it did happen. I know Captain Hindsight is, you know, having a wonderful time right now, making a lot of guest appearances. He's a really popular guy. But I don't think that you need Captain Hindsight to be able to do that. And bluntly, I would have expected Tuchel to have thought differently. I understand what Chelsea fans are saying, actually, because obviously, you know, I think there was a bit of that went on with Tuchel's Chelsea. But I wouldn't say that was the case with Tuchel's Dortmund, for example. I think but the Bundesliga is a very different league, and Dortmund occupy a different role in the Bundesliga that Chelsea occupy in the Premier League. So I don't know. I guess you think back to the Champions League final that Chelsea won. And yeah, you know, there was an awful lot of closing stuff out and shutting teams down. But I mean, again, as Jan points out, that is a well-drilled side over many, 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 many weeks of training. And it's not the same thing. It just reminded me of Anthony Barry's, like, half-time remarks. Anthony Barry, a massive feature of our World Cup. I mean, like, may the Saints preserve him and he prosper. But he was like saying, so it felt like we've dealt with all of the treatment that they gave us in the first half, and now it's time to take control of the game, show a bit of Premier League power in the second half. And up until Gordon's goal, that's kind of where it was going. And I think that's just it. It's just the way we just suddenly dropped off, the shocking change in momentum within seconds. It was alarming. We're going to have trauma for this for generations. They'll be talking about this game long after we're gone.
Yeah. Injustices, penalty shootouts, that's what we thrive on.
We live with that, yeah.
Just getting beaten.
Yeah.
That really, really hurts. And by our own design as well.
Mm.
Obviously, a lot of immediate reaction, Jan, was that Tuchel should go. Tuchel had made a huge error of judgment in that game. For one thing, not having any Arsenal players on the pitch. But as soon as he took Declan Rice off, that was it. No Arsenal players on the pitch. So it wasn't Arsenal's fault they went out, it was everyone else's. How do you feel now after a few days of decompressing? Are you still saying, get rid, this guy's made one big mistake too many, get someone else in, Nations League around the corner, get a nice run at that? What do you think now?
I think that he was brought in to do one thing on initially a very short contract and failed to do that. So part of me is like, well, okay, you know, you had a crack at the World Cup and you failed to deliver in quite a spectacular way at the end. But you said in your question there, has he made one mistake too many? You could argue he made one mistake. It was a big one and it cost England the place in the final, or it potentially cost England the place in the final. It cost England the place in the final. But there were some real highlights there and we saw some great performances across the side. Jeb Spence was, I thought, brilliant. I didn't think he started particularly well in the tournament, but I thought he ended it brilliantly. And of course, Bellingham was back to where we'd expect him to be, you know, like first season at Real Madrid, Bellingham, the one that we want to see. So there were some real highlights from that. To get to the semi-finals of the World Cup is pretty good. To expect to win it, there's an arrogance there when you've got a team like Spain and France before they went out. Sorry, I didn't mean to giggle there, but, you know, they did go out. But, you know, the semi-finals is a good finish. It is a good finish. Why should England expect to win the World Cup? They should expect to go there and give it a good go. And Tuchel got them that far and did that. So let's see what else he can do. Let's see what he can build on. He clearly could get a song out of them. That's not in doubt. You don't get to the semi-finals without that happening. There was a tactical misjudgment at the end. And as you said, that's going to live for a while. But he's got a chance to try and wash that clean and banish that memory and, you know, maybe get some success in the Euros. And maybe in 4 years' time, he's back and gives the World Cup another go and does it. Still a young side. They've still got plenty of go in them and plenty of space to grow and become better. So probably on balance, I wouldn't make a decision based on one game.
Terry, he did get a tune out of them. Sadly, it was Wonderwall. What do you think?
It would have been better, I think, if he had not extended his contract. I think it would have been better if he had just stuck to the original plan and just effectively sort of like been this sort of like guy who come in to just manage this project. I hear Jan's words about England, you know, and the expectations of winning the World Cup. But I think when you stack that, and you're right, Jan, absolutely right about that. With that said, I think that the manner with which we were knocked out, there was so much more that we could have done. I think that there's every chance if we got to the final, we probably would have lost to Spain because they're just that much better than everyone else. And I think that if that had happened, then we would have gone, ah, well, fair enough. There we go. We crack on and crack on to the Euros. But this is, I think what concerns me about this result is whether or not it causes any damages internally, or like within the FA and, of course, within the England dressing room. And we won't really know whether that's going to be the case for a while yet. So my feeling slash suggestion is this. Thomas Tuchel should qualify us for the final four of the Nations League. I won't be arrogant enough to say he should win it, because there are some good sides in Europe. We got Spain in our first game, and I think we've got Croatia and Czechia that we have to play. That is, I think, a perfect opportunity for England and for Thomas Tuchel to demonstrate that he can take the team forward into, you know, the Euros. So I think that the Nations League is now, for me, that has to be considered to be a priority for England. Do your absolute best to win that, at the very least qualify for the final four. If we get relegated to League B, then he should be fired out of a cannon and then sacked.
Well, of course, the Nations League is actually being expanded this year to a final eight.
Well, you really should get us into the final eight then.
Well, you only have to finish in the top two in your group.
Right.
We don't have to beat Spain. Obviously, I think it probably would do us a bit of good to beat Spain, actually. just to prove it to ourselves that we can. But I do think that that's actually a decent group. We did really well against Croatia, and Czechia were just pretty awful at this World Cup. Maybe they will have an overhaul. Maybe they'll bounce back from it. But yeah, interesting times ahead. The Nations League kicks off in the September break, where we'll be playing 4 matches. Home to Spain, away to Czechia, away to Croatia, and then a home to Croatia, all within the space of about 2 weeks. So exciting times there in the Nations League. And we'll all have forgotten that semi-final by then. Everything will be fine by then, right, guys?
It'll be, right, international break, September. Oh, that's what it'll be. Who cares about the semi-final? Oh, what about Sunderland, Crystal Palace, Arsenal?
Yeah, well, we do have all that to look forward to. What about the World Cup as a whole? The mammoth 104 game, 48 team, enjoy it while it lasts. 64 teams are coming. What are your overriding memories of the World Cup going to be, do you think, Jan?
Well, I'm just thinking back to the early stages of it, and I'd completely forgotten that Scotland were even in it, and that I was,
it was
amazed by
ago.
How wonderful. It's just that was months ago, wasn't it? Yeah, it feels long looking back. But actually, I mean, you said earlier on in the tournament that you were kind of warming to the larger tournament, and I think I have. I was worried that there were going to be teams that just did not deserve to be there, get absolutely annihilated, and it would be embarrassing. And that kind of didn't really happen. Cape Verde was a great example of a team that went for it and became kind of real heroes, really. It was great seeing Paraguay knock Germany out, and then their wonderful housery in the following games. So yeah, there was a lot going on. There was great, there were highs and lows for England throughout the tournament as well. And you know, we saw some great football. Well, let's concentrate on the positive things. There were some awful things that went on that had nothing to do with football but seemed to find their way in. But I'm a fan of the tournament being this size. I think it's okay. I was ready not to be. But putting up to 64? Well, let's see what Jan in 4 years' time says about that. I'd imagine he'll go, oh, no, a team isn't just going to get hammered. But yeah, what does he know? What does that guy know? The guy from a month ago or 10 years ago, whenever this World Cup actually started, he knew nothing. He knew nothing. And it was a pretty good World Cup all in. So yeah.
We love Jan from different time periods. Don't we, Terry?
Yeah, we do. My favourite Jan was, the sooner they bring in video evidence, the better, in my opinion. No, that's my second favourite man. My first favourite Jan is, you know what, we should ban all referees. That's my favourite Jan.
That was my favourite Jan as well.
I still think you're right about that, by the way.
Yeah, well, it's been proved right, isn't it? Look what VAR's done to the game.
And now what we've got? We've got 9 referees turning up for games.
Yeah, exactly.
Now,
9 of them.
9 of them. Terry, what about your memories of the World Cup?
Yeah, I think only Curaçao was the only blowout, wasn't it? And that was to Germany, wasn't it? All the fears we had about teams just like not showing up were all completely unfounded. There is always an element of group stage, festival of football, knockout stage, the World Championships. You know, sort of like it switches tone, becomes more urgent, the games become a lot tighter. It's always been an aspect of recent World Cups, particularly in this one, because there's just so many more teams. I'm not altogether certain the 64 team will happen, because I'm not altogether certain that the hosts will... I'm sure the hosts will have a view on hosting 64 teams. So I think that's a conversation that's had to be had. That Infantino just putting off all of the ghastliness, and there has been ghastliness. And I choose, like Jan, I think, if you don't mind, Graham, perhaps we can reflect on the ghastliness maybe over the course of the months and years between now and the next World Cup. Because let's face it, we're still going to be doing this in 4 years' time. So, but I probably think the thing that uppermost in my mind is Germany. And I think also there's a certain passage of time. I think that, you know, the globality of the world. I mean, we live in a global world. We all live in a global world. And, you know, we're seeing, you know, perhaps UEFA nations not having the kind of prominence that they have, the second tier UEFA nations actually being a bit better than we thought, but also the so-called top tier. I mean, I know Belgium did okay, but they could have been knocked out by Senegal. I think we look at Morocco and Senegal and look at African teams, and we can see that's a thing, obviously, CONCACAF. But it made me think about the Dutch and the Germans, for example, whom for a lot of their sort of post-war history, their culture and their identity as a nation has been bound up an awful lot by football and their national football team. And both seem to be in some kind of decline. Germany, I would suggest in particular, seem to be utterly directionless and they are in need of another reboot. And although it wasn't quite as catastrophic as, say, Italy, which is genuinely catastrophic, I think Jurgen Klopp's got a big job turning Germany around, because I think that that is a football nation that just doesn't seem to have any kind of identity at the moment. And yes, that's something to look forward to. But that was, I think, probably from a personal point of view, that was the most disappointing aspect of it. We're seeing, in a sporting sense, we're seeing Germany fail in the way that they did. But I won't miss the kickoff times. And I am looking forward to the fact that the next two World Cups are going to be in Europe-friendly time zones. But generally speaking, yeah, I think you have to say that it has been an enjoyable tournament.
Yes, of course, there are horrors attached to this World Cup. That's something we've got with every World Cup now, in the most recent ones and the ones to come. That is not going to go away because that's the world we live in now. You're right, I think this World Cup has been different because the teams that are at the top, they approach this very, very professionally. So the best teams in the world, the top four in the world, these were the four teams that were much better than everyone else. So I see what you say about the struggles of some European teams, but the no-show of Asian teams at this was quite concerning. Mm-hmm. And the fact that CONCACAF have nothing apart from the North American teams, and I can't see where that would come from, maybe Jamaica, maybe Costa Rica, but yeah, it didn't seem to materialise in this one either. Where are these extra teams coming from? Are they meant to be coming from Asia and CONCACAF? Maybe some more African teams. African teams did really well in the group stage. Got absolutely decimated in the round of 32. I just don't know. I mean, you look at that quarterfinal setup and you had, what, six UEFA teams? So three quarters of them? And yeah, and that doesn't seem to be going away anywhere anytime soon. And I suppose they're going to have to give a certain amount of UEFA slots to the 16 teams. Just to get Italy in, aren't they?
Just to get...
But we'll see. I think you're right, Terry. It's not going to be so easy for this one to get over the line. I think it's there in place just if someone is fool enough to stand up against him. But I think we've already found out that 200 FAs have now lent their support to Infantino. So yes, as we said last week, as you mentioned last week, he's probably going to stand unopposed unless there is some kind of blowback from the Balogun affair, which I think is the one thing that could jeopardise any future plans that Infantino has. And I think that's a very, 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 very tiny could.
Yeah, it's going to need the IOC to intervene in a fairly big way, for example, which I suppose is a possibility, but I don't see it. Because, I mean, everybody's got closets, right?
Yeah.
And everyone's got stuff in their closets. So. Yeah. I'm sure Gianni knows where all the bodies are buried. So,
well, there is that. And there's also the fact that there is an Olympic Games in LA in years' time. And let's see how well the IOC manage that as well, because they're going to have the same issues of letting people into the country that FIFA had. And they're going to be lent upon by this administration as well. So let's see how they cope with it. And I think that's Infantino's defense, isn't it? If the IOC start leaning on him, they're going to say, well, good luck to you, go on, over you go and see how far you get.
Gianni could charge him a consultancy fee to help
probably
them
will won't he yeah. Yeah, just as long as he's at the top of their VVIP list,
no doubt.
Well, we've got another 4 years before we got another World Cup, but we've got Nations League before then, and then we'll have a Euros. It's going to be great, loads of fun and games over the next few years. But, of course, club football is going to be our focus next, isn't it? Because the new season's going to start soon. And, of course, we're coming back. We're coming back for our new season. Season 18. 18 seasons of The Sound of Football, yeah. It's going to be special. It's going to be special. We're going to be coming back in 3 weeks' time.
Yeah, were you aware of this?
I wasn't aware of this.
I didn't see the memo.
I mean, this is not looking after podcaster welfare.
I put it up on Lamppost as the local authority asked me to 2 months ago.
Which lamppost?
There was that huge banner outside the tavern. Did you not see it?
Yeah, for reasons that we have yet to discuss on this podcast, I don't really go to Whiteleaf that much these days. All right, 3 weeks then.
3 weeks' time.
I know it's not your fault, Graham, but it's someone's fault. Anyway, that is another story.
Listeners, you can see why my messages on WhatsApp go for 3 days unread, can't you?
That's just massively untrue.
Well, there's some truth unread, in it. There is some unread, truth in it.
Yeah, unread by Graham. You don't even read your own messages, mate.
That's because I know how boring they are.
Oh, double grey tick Sibley over there.
It's true, listeners. It's very, very, very true. I'm the Gianni Infantino of our WhatsApp group.
He really is. He really is. Right then, so 3 weeks then. That's excellent.
Yes, 3 weeks. But that is all we have time for this tournament. So from me, Graham Sibley, from Jan Bilton, and from Terry DeFillon, it's goodbye.
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 Get in touch with us on Blue Sky or Instagram, where we are at Sound of Football, or go to sofpodcast.com. Like us, share us, rate us and review us. Do it now!
Kevin, only a few weeks ago you ended up in hospital with a physical reaction to overwork. Is that not a sign that the pressures are in fact getting to you?
Well, I was competing in Superstars and I was racing on a bike at the time. And I fell off on a bend and had a bad accident. And to be quite honest, I'd pushed my body too hard for about a week, trying to cram in things which, in all fairness, not only charity things, but things that, you know, I was endorsing. So financially I was doing well also. So I rushed about doing a lot of things, trying to help a lot of people. And the doctor summed it up. He said, your body's like a car. You can drive it 100 miles an hour, he says, and you've been driving yours around about 130 miles an hour for about 3 or 4 weeks. And quite honestly, he said something had to give. He said, if you'd have been older, it could have been your heart. And I really don't know what this stomach pain was I got, but I've never, ever experienced anything like it. And I said, well, my wife said, that's it, you're finished, you're not going to open any fates, you're not going to do this, that, and the other. And then next week, I was back doing them again.